Hello, enormous listening world, and welcome back to Big Mouth, the Bilderberg group of music, films, telly and books, where we secretly control the destiny of all the pop stars, actors, comedians and writers. I'm Andrew Harrison, and this week we will be digging into Armando Iannucci's new movie, The Death of Stalin. It's annoying Russian nationalists and Putin fans across the internet, which is a good thing, but is it funny? The 40th anniversary special edition of New Boots and Panties by Ian Dury. How does the foul-mouthed and dirty-minded William Blake of Upminster stack up in our current age of looking for what's inappropriate at every turn? Plus, Mindhunter, Hannibal Lecter meets the Nixon era in the new Netflix detective series, and an album that does pretty much what it says on the tin. Even a tree can shed tears, Japanese folk and rock, 1969 to 1973. How can we possibly make sense of all of this? Only with the help of two very special guests. Jude Rogers is a key member of our Welsh guest product range, a veteran of the Word magazine and Q, who now writes for The Guardian and presents for Radio 4. She is an inveterate indie gal and has made the trip down to the Frightening Smoke specially. Hello, Judith. How are you?
Hello. I'm very well, thank you.
Now, you were so in love with London that you used to do a fanzine called Smoke about all the love and poison of London.
I did.
Now, does it freak you out now that you're a country girl again?
Yeah, it's weird. I was just coming out of Euston today and being terrified by the mobs, the hordes. It's funny, I've readjusted very quickly. But I still do like wandering around Soho and trying to find the little bits of old Soho in between all the shiny boutique eclectic steakhouses. And what I saw something was an eclectic steakhouse earlier.
What's an eclectic steakhouse? It's a steak, but then this one's a shoe.
Yeah, well, probably served in a shoe,
eclectic
knowing
steaks,
Soho these days.
Surely.
But,
random
yeah,
animals.
I still love London, but I'm one with the Zen of the Countryside, man.
Well, you kind of, Smoke magazine sort of invented modern Londonism in a way, did it, with London's campus statues and stories about the underground and all the rest of it. Could you do it now that it's been Borised out of existence and the place is all these gigantic, terrible, stupid skyscrapers that look like children's toys?
Yeah, definitely. I think Smoke had a bit of a political edge to it. You know, the thing that happened with Smoke was, you know, the independent bookshop decline. Although there are some great independent bookshops now saying that. Boring things about distribution and manufacturing it and all that kind of stuff basically killed it in the end. It's very hard to do these things on a shoestring these days. And there's this thing called the internet, where lots of people do, you know, slightly copy ideas we might have had in the past and do them themselves. So there's that. It was a very lovely time. And yes, I do get slightly annoyed when I see the hordes of the piles of London secret whatever books, and they're all not as good as Smoke. But we've moved on. I've moved on.
You should stick it up on the internet. You should stick it all up on the internet and say how we did it.
There is lots of it still up on the internet, on our Smoke London Peculiar website, which is not updated anymore, but lots of the old stuff is there.
There you go.
And there are still copies of our Olympics book, our two copies of the board game we did. If anybody wants a very hard board game based around taxi rides around Soho, give me a call.
Fantastic. Well, also with us, giving a much-needed voice to the metropolitan media elite, from whom we hear so very little, is ex-Guardian music editor Michael Hann. As well as writing for his old paper, Michael does stuff for The Quietus, The FT, and anyone else who will have him. And he was my carer when we went to see Marillion by mistake at the Albert Hall last week. Hello, Michael.
Hello. I'm very well, thank you, Andrew. Very well.
Now, did going to see Marillion at the Albert Hall change your mind about Marillion, as you and I were promised?
Well, it should be put into context that I didn't say to Andrew, come and see Marillion. A mutual friend of ours from university said, you two, you've scorned Marillion, come and see Marillion. So we agreed to go. But the context for this is that back in the very distant times when I was a very young boy, I did love Marillion. I gave up when kind of indie started entering my life, but I saw Marillion quite a few times. And the thing that I enjoyed about that Marillion show, rather more than Marillion, was the kids who were standing next to us up in the gods.
And this is actually kids. When you say kids, you don't mean people only in their early 50s. You mean actual
they were 25. Early 20s, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a brother and sister who'd come down from Carlisle specially for the show. And the lad had heard Marillion, I think, on the radio in the service station where he worked and thought they were amazing and started tracking down their records and introduced his sister to them. And they were so excited to be there. It was a show with an interval, because obviously Marillion played their new album in its entirety first, then there was an interval, then they came back with a small orchestra, as one does. And during the interval, I was outside the Albert Hall having a fag and got talking to these young kids who were standing next to us upstairs. And they were asking what I thought of it, and I explained that, well, to be honest, it's not really my bag, but we're here because this guy wants us to come and see them. But I used to see Marillion quite a lot, and they went, wow, really? I said, oh, yeah. I remember seeing them do Grendel live at the Hammersmith Odeon, which is an 18-minute song based on Northern European folklore. Mm-hmm. And they reacted with the kind of looks of awed astonishment that I would, if I'd been chatting to someone and they'd said, oh, I saw the Ramones at the Roundhouse on July 4th, 1976, supporting Flaming Groovies. It was exactly that kind of same moment of cultural import. They were, oh my God, you saw Grendel.
Did you want to touch you?
They didn't want to touch me, and that would have been inappropriate.
It would have been inappropriate.
But I was really charmed by just looking at the pleasure they were taking from... Even in literally the worst place you could be in the Albert Hall where we were, which is up at the very top gallery, right round at the side. So, in fact, slightly behind the band, but just being there thrilled them.
It was rather touching. It was rather touching. Also with us, ensuring that we have a solid base going forward in order to pluck the low-hanging fruit and pick up the easy wins, it's our producer, the Dale Carnegie podcast, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
When was the last time you went to see a band by mistake under protest?
Under protest. Does taking your daughter to go and see Little Mix count? That was kind of
interesting. That must have been quite good.
It was quite fun. It was the We Are Weird tour, which is or something. It was something like that. It was like, we're really weird, and everyone was holding up signs saying we're weird, and it's quite that was kind of interesting sociology. Well, it was good fun seeing kind of 12-year-old girls go to their get really excited at their first concert, actually. But the music, I have to say.
But I'm sure that did the mix put on a decent show? Did it have production values?
The mix
values?
Put on, yeah. I tell you, what's the Black Magic one? You know, the song.
The
about
song's called Black Magic.
Black Magic, yeah. There they have kind of like lots of. They all come out in kind of Vampirella costumes, and they have male dancers stripped to the waist and oiled up for the. You know, so yeah, I think it's. And they're kind of high kicking all over, wearing kind of kinky thigh high boots and stuff.
Is this appropriate for 12-year-old girls?
Yeah, it's empowering.
It's like Bananarama in '87 on the Brits when they came on with all the naked dancers.
And it's like the wedding present that leads a story in '87.
They came on with the naked dancers, and
they were all greased up as well.
Yeah, sort of David Gedge stripped to the waist and oiled up. It's slightly disturbing.
Grappler in his undies. Okay. Well, before we get cracking, a couple of small and gentle reminders. If you enjoy Big Mouth, then please do subscribe via Apple Podcasts and leave us a nice review and star rating if you can. It helps us stay visible and gets us more listeners. And you also might enjoy our sister show, Romaniacs, the No Bullshit Brexit podcast, also available on Apple Podcasts and all major platforms. Every week, Romaniacs looks at the unfolding mess of Brexit with humour and insight. You can find all the links at romaniacs.com. And if you're a Romaniacs listener who has wandered over to Big Mouth, hello, it's lovely to have you here. Okay then, pop music. For many people, the album of 1977 and 1978 was an oddball collection of grubby poetry, dirty jokes, handmade disco and cockney wordplay called New Boots and Panties. The artist was, in his own words, a raspberry ripple and one of the most unsettling pop stars ever. At 35, Ian Dury was too old for punk, but his menacing demeanour, black humour and the consequences of the polio that had afflicted him as a child made him more disturbing than a barrel of Captain Sensibles. This debut album sold 300,000 copies, made him a star, and put a figure who resembled a mixture of Smike and Bill Sykes on Top of the Pops. There had been nothing like Dury before, and there's been nothing like him since. New Boots and Panties is now out in a four-disc 40th anniversary edition. How does it stand up? Let's find out after this. This song was actually never on the original album, but here's a notably different John Peel session version from the album of Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. Roll my brain and body need. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. Very good indeed. Keep your silly ways or throw them out the window. The wisdom of your ways. I've been there and I know. Ian Dury with the Peel session version of Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. The Blockheads hadn't properly formed by then and is backing band, and the album's credited just to Ian Dury. Jude Rodgers, you literally were not born when this record came out. What did you make of it?
I was a glimmer in my father's eye. Well, it's funny, I've got a bit of a long-term kind of love of Ian Dury from one single, really, Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick, which was one of the few 7-inch singles in my house growing up, weirdly. My mother was basically just interested in the Beatles, Neil Diamond and Ralph McTell. My stepfather didn't really listen to anything apart from church music, Welsh hymns, occasionally a cassette that had come free off the Daily Mirror, that kind of thing. My stepfather also had the 7-inch of Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. And I remember seeing this cover as a teen and just thinking it's very weird. And eventually kind of playing it because I was a bit scared of it and loving it. I absolutely loved it.
Did it have that fantastic cover?
Yes.
With the dog, the wooden blocks that yes. go to make up a dog. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I think that intrigued Barney me first of all. Yeah. But, you know, it was this, you know, huge, you know, song that kind of caught everybody, everybody's minds in some ways. I get the impression from the time, because you mentioned that song, you know, which, you know, we're not talking about here, but kind of there was something about his personality behind that song that just intrigued people and grabbed people. This sort of proto Del Boy, with a, you know, a far lewder kind of tone to him. Listening to this album now as a 39-year-old woman, speaking as a woman, see photo, I find it really, well, the bits I liked were the bits I liked back then, which were, you know, his way for rhyme, you know, rhyming coerced and worst, more of that, you know, kind of his, the interesting uses of names of London suburbs and... you know, the there's lots of humour in his writing, and there's just some fantastic phrases. You know, you know, when somebody has lazy skin and ashtray eyes, you know, it's fantastic yeah. writing. But I found it very disturbing to listen to. I must say, I listened to this while supervising a 3-year-old on Sunday, while under the while suffering from tonsillitis, which is probably the right environment to listen to Ian Dury. I had to turn it off fairly quickly, obviously.
It's quite rude and quite foul-mouthed.
Yeah, it's quite rude and quite foul-mouthed. My little boy loved running around to it and was singing something. He was singing Betsy, Betsy, Rock and Roll, which I'm glad he wasn't singing Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. I'm glad he didn't quite understand those first two words. But I found it disturbing on other levels. You know, you can't get away from this really grim thread of misogyny that runs through it. You know, obviously it was known at the time that he was a complicated character. I've read interviews since with his son Baxter, who's great, and he's got a record out around now as well. I've heard a few things off that, and he says, you know, he was a complicated character. He liked to pick on people's points of weakness.
Yeah.
But there's lots in here about picking on points of women's weakness, which, you know, at the moment with the cultural debates going on, you know, going on in the wider world, you can't help but think about it. You know, if I was with a woman, you know, it's about him having been slighted by a particular woman, obviously. You know, the phrases that come through that you wouldn't expect, you know, a decent man to use.
And there's the line in Wake Up and Make Love With Me where he likes it when you're sleeping, but when you're awake is the best. Well, mate, when she's sleeping,
yeah.
there's a word for that.
I listened to that about 4 or 5 times because first time I heard it, I thought, you know, this time around, I was thinking, is he saying what I think he's saying? And then listened to it again. I was thinking, you know, basically I think that he's not meaning he is... You know,
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of
I don't know. I don't know.
But it's very ambiguous. Yeah. And to start a record with that, it's very, you know, it's very disturbing. It's horrible.
Yeah, it absolutely is a sleazy record. There's no doubts about it. And I don't think it would play. If you came out something like this now, it would definitely play exceedingly badly. There would be incoming think pieces like you wouldn't believe. I think you just have to see it in context at the time, you know.
Yeah, but seeing it in context of the time, you know, you can see... You know, the work of, you know, Harry Weinstein in the early 90s in the context of the time.
Well, no, I don't think that's true. You can't see actual sexual assault in the context of the time.
This whole thing about seeing things in the context of their time, I was thinking about it the other day. Now, it doesn't apply to people like Weinstein because those are just crimes. But think about things in the context of the time. The context is always defined by men. It is always men saying, I thought it was okay. And it means because other men didn't say it was okay. No one ever asks the women, what did you think in the context of the time? Was it okay?
And you read at the time about his experiences with this woman, his wife, you know, the mother of Baxter, the other woman he was with. He wasn't particularly pleasant a character, to put it very, very mildly. You know, just there's so many lines like, you know, I'd threaten to unload her, you know, kind of fill her up, you know, in blockheads. It just, you know, this is, you know, somebody who I've always thought of quite highly as a musician. You know, there's so many interesting bits of music in here. You know, the music at the beginning of Wake Up and Make Love to Me, it's just like something from a Steve Reich record just coming in.
It's quite weird about how they were, the band, were regarded as part of the punk movement because they're so... more connected with kind of jazz funk and what was going on musically. You know, you've got Chas Jankel, who went on to make kind of like essentially fantastic funk records. You've got kind of a band like Norman Watt, you know, with people like Norman Watt Roy in, who are still kind of making fantastic, really sexy dance records, you know.
Yeah.
And the backing to that's kind of, I think, one of the things that makes it so disturbing. You know, if this was a kind of Sub Lurkers style 3-minute thrash underneath it, you'd be like, a bunch of, you know, complete idiots who haven't got an original thought and are just totally misogynist.
And I'm absolutely...
But it's the fact that this music is kind of that is layered with words that are at one point, or in fact always, even when they're kind of coming out with, even when he's coming out with quite disturbing images and quite kind of misogynistic stuff, the words are always really poetic, you know. Whether it, however he's using it, he is very good at putting those words together.
I just want to say, and I'm not saying that any work of art should be null and void because the person who made it might be a bit of a misogynist. You know, I am somebody who is doing a big project at the moment about T.S. Eliot. You know, you can, you know, in terms of misogyny, it runs right through all his poetry. He's still my favourite poet. Yeah. Mm. I wouldn't want to go to the pub with him. Yeah. And I wouldn't go to the pub with Ewan Deary. And, you know, and I completely understand the separation of those two things. They're still worth in the art. But listening to this that keeps recurring and recurring in this mainstream pop record, I do wonder, as Michael said, you know, what a lot of women thought listening to it at the time. Oh, blokes are just like that.
The person he's, you know, we've never fully known if the person that he played on a record is him.
Of course.
You know, and there's a lot, clearly there's an awful lot of role playing going on in this record, which you later see appears in songs by Madness and Blur. You know, he's kind of...
Not
in this, in the misogyny, yes, but yeah. The idea of playing a role within, being a character in a tune. Yeah. Billet Ricky Dickey is not Ewan Deary, he's playing a character.
Yeah.
So, and that's always, for some reason, that's difficult in pop music where it's not in drama, theatre,
writing,
etc.
It's absolutely true. I often ask musicians, songwriters about the fact that people always believe songs are about them, which they don't with novels and films and anything like that. And it's a source of frustration to a lot of writers. However, with Ewan Deary, now I've not read biogs of Ewan Deary, but I have seen the biopic. Yeah. And it's fairly clear from the biopic that the character he portrays in his songs is not always terribly different from the person he actually was in real life. I mean, they're not autobiographical. He's not talking about incidents in his life, but the personality traits are the things that apparently were what made him.
But isn't it a case with New Boots and Pansies? This is a fantastic pop, dance, disco record, which finishes in an amazing, splenetic, bilious, three-part punk, you know, explosion with Blackmail Man and Blockheads. It's a great, great record with this layer that is increasingly hard to ignore of deep unpleasantness.
Also, I think
it's great. I think it's really interesting. There's some great, you know, great ideas on it. There's some great musicianship. You know, it's really, you know, I do love it when you're hearing somebody starting a song with basically a list of, you know, a list of rude terms about people. You know, it's kind of just, it's in your face. But it's also, like nothing else. Still can't get past everything.
Just to say that, you know, when it came out, it wasn't the pop record. He wasn't yet a pop star. He wasn't everyone's favourite.
I know that.
So when, you know, it didn't sell at all, and the singles, which was previous, was Sweet Jean Vincent, and that hadn't charted. You know, so in fact, it was Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. Mm. He was not at that point a pop star. He was a guy who'd like scuffed around on the pub rock circuit for years with absolutely no kind of success. So I don't think he was intending to be a pop star.
I think there's differences between these little, you know, euphemisms and things that, you know, there are songs that are just about misogyny. Yeah, the laughing at the end of that song I find it really disturbing. He meant it to be disturbing, I am sure. But the consistency of it in this record, it just really surprised me because I didn't hear it before. And I don't know if it's because I'm older, because I'm thinking about different things at the moment. I'd still dance to, you know, Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, don't get me wrong.
Anyway, we're going to move on. Let's get back to now. Every week, we ask our guests to bring in a song to play, their own personal editor's recommendation, if you like. Jude Rogers, what have you brought in for the show?
I've brought in a track by Kelly Lee Owens, who is on Small Town Super Sound and is a hip, young, beautiful electronic music producer and singer. She's from a little tiny village in North Wales, and I came across her because I was a judge on the Welsh Music Prize recently. The Welsh Music Prize is always great. Like every little regional music prize I've ever done, I've done the Scottish Award of the Album of the Year Award. I do the Nordic Music Prize.
Are you Rent-a-Celt?
I am basically Rent-a-Region. Rent-a-Regional.
Hear her when she does the Scottish one. She's got this amazing Glaswegian accent.
It's good because it's almost these regional prizes a lot of them are voted for by people who run record shops and local producers, and the voting is very different. And you get much more variety. So this year, of course, we have Griff Rhys, because you have to have Griff Rhys every year in the Welsh Music Prize, but with his fantastic soundtrack to that film about Dylan Thomas that came out a couple of years ago. And we've also, it's really good. If you haven't heard it, you like it, Andrew. And we had really weird doom metal, funk, all these kind of different things made by bands who were either born or live within Wales. Mm. And I never heard of Kelly Lee Owens before, and I think this is great.
Well, here we go. This is Kelly Lee Owens from Stereophonics with with Lucid. Kelly Lee Owens with Lucid, as chosen by Jude Rogers in a massive episode of Welsh Favouritism. Now, listeners, how do you feel about Stalin? Stalin apologists used to appear only on the weirdo fringes. Now he can always rely on somebody's pop-up and say, oh, well, at least he wasn't Hitler. Armando Iannucci's new movie, The Death of Stalin, imagines exactly what would have happened when one of history's top three monsters finally carked it. The cast is incredible. Steve Buscemi, Andrea Riseborough, Jeffrey Tambor, Jason Isaacs. And it's already being attacked by Russian nationalists as insulting to the memory of a guy who only managed to kill between 30 and 60 million people. How could they be so mean? Luckily, we have someone here who knows his Stalin inside out to help us through the movie. Michael Hann, BA First Class, Politics and Parliamentary Studies, Leeds University, 1989. He'll be presenting his paper after this taster.
Stalin's dead.
Stalin is dead!
Lookalikes, I think their contract's up.
We need change.
How can you run and plot at the same time?
Nobody's gonna get killed, I promise you.
What's a war hero got to do? Get some lubrication around here.
I know the drill. Smile, shake hands, and try not to call them.
One day, my brother just rode a pig through here.
Oh, that must have been messy.
It was terribly messy.
Stalin will be loving this.
All of you can kiss my Russian ass.
I'm off to represent the entire Red Army at the buffet. You girls enjoy yourself.
The Death of Stalin, directed by Armando Iannucci and starring Steve Buscemi, Jeffrey Tambor and many another famous face. Michael Hann, you're an unreconstructed Stalinist. Set this film up for us.
That's slightly harsh. And when you say I'm a Stalin expert, what we mean is I did a year-long course in Stalinism at university. So 25 years ago, yeah. I knew a lot about Stalin. Okay. I wouldn't say quite so much now.
Yeah.
So the setup of The Death of Stalin is the Politburo is bumbling along merrily. They're deciding who to kill, who to purge. They all go back to Stalin's house, have to watch a Western, or the rest of the Politburo are all quite fed up of it. Stalin goes to bed, and then there's the sound of him falling over, and the guards are too afraid to go in, lest, you know, they get killed. Turns out Stalin's had a massive brain hemorrhage, shortly thereafter dies.
Not a spoiler.
That's at the beginning of the film. The end of the film, he comes back to life. That is a story.
Zombie Stalin too. This time it's personal.
But the film is about the paranoia that exists within the Politburo in the wake of Stalin's death. It's an extremely black comedy and how everything could change from minute to minute, which was true of real Stalinism. You know, you could be in favour in the morning, out of favour at lunchtime, back in favour by the time you had your tea in the afternoon. Mm. And this is dealt with kind of so perceptively. There's a tremendous scene where Michael Palin, playing Molotov, the foreign secretary, not one of history's good guys, Ribbentrop-Molotov pact, let's not forget.
Yeah.
Not really one of history's good guys. Who's clearly denounced his wife, and he thinks his wife is dead. And Khrushchev has come round to plot with him. Khrushchev, played by Steve Buscemi, as Steve Buscemi. And Beria. Simon Russell Beale walks in and mentions Molotov's wife, and Michael Palin says, oh, no, she was a traitor. She betrayed Stalin. She betrayed the party. She deserved to die. And the wife walks in. And then, ah! And Steve Buscemi says...
And it's so great that she's not... Yeah.
Yes, yes. And then later on, but he's still trying to work this through, and he keeps later in the film saying, but she betrayed the party. He's still never quite sure which way the wind is blowing.
And this is essentially a film, to me, this is a film that's about Beria more than anything else, because Beria is the monster in the fold.
Well, Beria, I think, and Jason Isaacs playing Zhukov, who's the other central character, I think, and is the the single best thing in the film, because everyone else is fundamentally playing. Jeffrey Tambor is playing Jeffrey Tambor. Steve Buscemi is playing Steve Buscemi. Jason Isaacs portraying Zhukov as this, as hail of, fellow well-met Yorkshireman, yeah, will kill you as soon as look yeah, at you.
As one of the four Yorkshiremen.
Now, Judith Rogers, your favourite part of this movie was it only cost you £2.90 to see it because you saw it in a non-London cinema.
I just seek it out in Wales because it only came out on Friday, didn't it? But I found it.
Enjoy The Death of Stalin?
I did enjoy The Death of
what
Stalin.
What about the film?
I loved it. I loved it. I've seen a lot of criticism of it, as you were saying in your introduction, about it's not as funny as some of Andrew Nietzsche's former films. You know, it's a critique of Stalinism done through black humour. You know, it's not kind of slapstick. Mm. I thought it was very funny. I thought it was very disturbing in lots of it. That's the fact that you've got all these actors that you know incredibly well who are not playing different versions of themselves. You know, Michael Palin is recognisably Michael Palin, as we know, as a non-actor as well as an actor. Steve Buscemi has none of the Bardock Empire horribleness that he had in that. Yeah. He is more of a comedy character from films we've known from the past. So as we've known a lot of these people for a long time, I think that amplifies the fear factor, actually, yeah, massively. Obviously, the use of everyone's own accents helps as yeah, well.
Well, it's great that nobody's actually impersonating a Russian. I mean, Sally Hughes was on the show last week, and she was talking a lot about that, how it's like, it's good that nobody is being a Russian, they're being themselves. No. And to me, it really underscores, well, if you want to see the banality of evil.
Absolutely.
They are banal people.
Absolutely.
They're not people with vision. They're small-minded, bumbling, ruthless individuals.
You know, obviously, he's making a comment about politics of our times as well, and how these things can turn on a dime.
I kind of disagree, because they do have a vision. It's not a very nice vision, but Beria managed to organise like the one of the most frighteningly efficient secret services and kill millions of people.
He's amazing.
But that's not a vision. That's an organisational genius put to the service of evil. It's not a vision.
The vision is principally just about preserving one's own power in an age of paranoia. But I think when we say it's a black comedy about Stalinism, I don't think it really is, because why do we need a black comedy about Stalinism 60-odd years after he died? What it is for me, it kind of resonates with how people become afraid of power and unwilling to talk, and that talks to Trump.
Yeah,
definitely.
Absolutely. But also to Putin. I mean, I would say that we do need a black comedy about Stalinism right now, because it's pretty much the first time in decades when you can see supposedly legitimate voices in the paper saying, oh, was it all that bad? Was it all that bad?
And the fact that they're played, the characters play themselves in quite a modern way, you know. Oh. You know, it just makes it more frightening. You know, this Zhukov, Jason Isaacs, I've never seen him play comedy before. I don't know, it's just me. I thought he was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah,
both
amazing.
Hilarious and incredibly handsome, but also terrifying. Rupert Friend, I thought, was brilliant as well, as Stalin's son.
Stalin, yeah.
You know, he's just so ridiculous and... when you see him playing, he's playing the fool and he's being ridiculous and everybody's saying, basically he's this ridiculous character while they're being more ridiculous within themselves. I think that's really interesting.
And
as
also,
well.
Adrian McLaughlin playing kind of Stalin as some sort of like Alf Garnett.
Yeah.
East End,
brilliant.
Who wants to watch a Western?
Yeah, it was brilliant.
I've got to talk for a minute, though, at least a minute, about Simon Russell Beale as Barry, who is a fantastic monster in this film. He is so coldly terrifying, dispatching orders for mass killings, able to turn on a Kopeck to get we talk about Ian Dury finding your weak point. Barry is looking for everyone's weak point at all times. They're all clearly terrified of him, and rightly so. The only slight kink I had with it was, in order to make Barry the monster, has Armando Nietzsche slightly cutesified Khrushchev, Molotov, and so forth? These were not nice people.
Well, it's not for here, but I thought it was quite an interesting thing that it ended where it did.
Yeah,
and it baldly ends where it does, with just a couple of captions. Not, because you couldn't do it then, summing up the next 50 years of Soviet history. Yeah. But,
But one of the characters you mentioned
Khrushchev,
at the end, I think the fact that he isn't portrayed in a terrifying way throughout, it makes it more terrifying at the
end.
But
also Khrushchev, did then go on kind of like a few years after the end of this film to like stand up at whatever...
he gave the secret speech.
He gave the massive speech where he completely denounced Stalin and said this was like a terrible stain on our country's history.
Which did not make him a popular man in the Central Committee.
Which is one of the reasons why Brezhnev kind of put him out to pasture a few years later. And of course, but at the same time there was all the Cold War stuff going on, and he's banging his shoe famously on the desk at the UN. So, you can't sum up a whole character's, which is what I thought happened really well, was that you've just got these kind of snapshots of these characters at that period of time.
But Simon Russell Beale is just, if he doesn't win an award for that, you know, he's just like this kind of evil slug kind of just creeping slowly through all these rooms.
But
and
also
doing
that,
all stuff. Oh,
that bit when he's going through the NKVD secret police headquarters, and there's just basically in the background as he walks past the staircase, somebody's being kicked down the staircase. Yeah. You know, it shouldn't be funny, but you can just see this kind of like,
it's the normalized,
it's just all going on. Yeah. You know, it's so brilliant.
I thought it was absolutely fantastic, and I'd recommend it to anyone. We're generally giving it a thumbs up.
Yeah.
There's a great voting scene where the hands are raised, and everybody wants to see if their hand is being raised at the right time. I'm raising my hand now.
Unanimous.
We loved it. Unanimous. All right, we're going to move on to a bit more music. This is the band that me and Michael Hahn went to see last night. Michael, this is your choice of tune, isn't it? Tell us what we've got here.
It is. I can't remember. It's called Satan, Luella and I, or Luella, Satan and I.
It's Satan, Luella and I, and it's grammatically incorrect because it should be Satan, Luella and me. But
it
anyway,
should.
And the band is?
HMLTD, the former Happy Meal Limited, who, for my money, are the most extraordinary live band at work in this country right now. Certainly the most extraordinary live band with any eye on the mainstream. When I say eye on the mainstream, it's kind of all relative. What they are is this bizarre mélange of all sorts of different music. There's goth, there's early 80s electro, there's art rock, there's spaghetti western. If you don't like one style of music, don't worry, there'll be another one along in a moment.
In the same song.
In the same song, usually. And they're the most extraordinarily theatrical group. I've seen them several times now, and every time I just want to laugh out loud at the sheer uproarious chutzpah of it all.
Well, let's have a listen to the sheer uproarious chutzpah of HMLTD with Satan, Luella and I. Satan, Luella and I, as chosen by Michael Hahn. I mean, I thought this was an astounding show. It was very Alien Sex Fiend. It was Jubriath fronting Alien Sex Fiend, I thought. They need songs.
Yeah.
They haven't got any songs. They've got a whole load of action, stupid outfits, crazy haircuts, insane presentation. They need some songs, I thought.
The songs are good enough to entertain at the moment. If they want to be pop stars, if they want to be Duran Duran, then, yeah, they do need proper songs. I've heard stories, I don't know if they're true, that they're getting the professional songwriters in, which on the one hand, yeah, it'll make them better. On the other, it'll probably destroy what it is that makes them so appealing anyway. I think they were kind of mad to sign to Sony, I've got to say, because Sony will want proper hits out of them, and if they don't deliver proper hits, they'll be put on the dumper, and that'll be it for them. But they played at End of the Road this summer. And my wife overheard two middle-aged women in the tent next to us talking about having seen them the previous day, and one of them saying, "Did you see that group HMLTD?" And they went, "No, what were they like?" "Well, oh, it just reminded me of being in love with Duran Duran when I was 14. And I think that's what they want to be.
There you go. Well, let's have a terribly sharp contrast, and we're going to go to Japan in the late 1960s. While the counterculture is sweeping the world, Japanese youth is doing its own thing by rejecting both clean-cut group music and college folk in favour of a painfully authentic homegrown sound they called, wait for it, new music. Pretty much nobody in the West knows this stuff, but it is now compiled on Even a Tree Can Shed Tears, Japanese Folk and Rock, 1969 to 1973, from Light in the Attic Records. We're going to have a look at it after this taster. This is the Japanese Joni Mitchell, Sachiko Kanenobu. Is that a Japanese pronunciation of cannonball, I wonder? Kanonobu? Anyway. And the tune is Anata Karo Toku E. Sachiko Kanenobu with Anata Kara Toko E. God knows if I pronounced that correctly, and I have no idea what it means.
I'm a betting man.
But so what? Silence, silence. Jude Rogers, this is up your street. What did you say?
It's sort of catnip to me, this kind of stuff. I spent most of the mid-2000s listening to compilations like this when psychedelic folk music was coming back into fashion.
What, from that gigantic pile of Japanese folk and rock that's out there?
Not yeah. Japanese. There was a compilation called Gathering the Mushrooms that Bob Stanley had a hand in, which was fantastic. This was mainly English and Scottish and vaguely Wickermanny kind of folk, which I looked up on Amazon the other day, and it was it's very rare now, and it's the compilation is rare and costs £200 or something, or CD, ridiculously. It's funny, I put this on the weekend when I had some friends around for Sunday lunch.
Your tea yeah.
You know, there where I was, you know, looking at the hills of England over the border with my friend Jess, who likes this kind of music, and we were listening to it. It's sort of easy listening for people like me, isn't it, this kind of music? It's nice. There's lots of interesting stuff on it. I say interesting, not in a deeply interesting, you know, just kind of, oh, that's interesting. I've forgotten about it 2 minutes later. It's funny, I like listening to this stuff in the background, but it's background music for me. There's nothing that lives up in my mind to the grand pronouncements you get in the press release. You know, the Japanese Joni Mitchell, it's a woman who plays the guitar and has a slightly interesting way with a melody.
Well, of course, there's a real problem when you're listening to singer-songwriter stuff in a language you have no idea what it is.
That's
because
a fair point.
You have no idea what the lyrics say. So I find it almost impossible to listen to that stuff for that reason. I mean, there were bits of kind of the rock stuff that I quite liked. I enjoyed, again, forgive pronunciation, Japanese listeners, Arthur Hakase no Jinkiri Hikuki by Kazuhiko Kato. That one I thought was an interesting rock song, but the whole album felt to me like one of those series of albums that, say you're in a bar, a kind of groovy bar, and they put on a groovy record that you've never heard of and you have no idea what it is in the way that that kind of bar does, and you go, hey, this is good, and then you find out what it is and you go and buy it and you get it home and go, doesn't sound as good listening to at home.
Doesn't
than
sound
it
as good
did.
You're not half cut is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, doesn't sound as good half cut when it's on kind of in the background and you're talking to your mates and you're hearing snatches of it. When you actually listen to, how many tracks, 20 tracks of it, it's 19 tracks. It's not really quite so appealing over that distance.
I think there's, I mean, this is definitely not my thing, but I think there's Cocteau Twins value here. You know, we're all perfectly able to appreciate music where we don't understand what the words mean. You know, most of my favorite music.
Yes, yeah. But when it's a singer, when it's a singer songwriter song, when it's some one voice and an acoustic guitar, and you have no idea what it means,
yeah.
The lyrics are 50% of the song in that.
That's
case.
That's why I hate singer songwriter music. Singer songwriter.
Singer songer.
Singer songer. Get rid of the singer songers. There is an element of more obscure than now appeal here, though, isn't
of
there?
Course,
for a certain
yeah.
kind of person, this is really going to float their boat.
You know, this label, like In the Attic, this is what they do. They are the new finders keepers. They're a bit like, you know, the folkier kind of ambient yacht rock end of soul jazz or something like that.
But they've done
that.
Some really, you know, but I always thought that, I mean, a lot of the stuff that I've got from them before was kind of whole albums that was that have been discovered,
yeah.
like that kind of that gospel one. Of Bob Dylan tracks.
Oh, yeah,
which
fantastic.
Is absolutely fantastic.
It's fantastic.
This
yeah.
just has a little bit of a kind of, we're finding it because it's a bit weird and you
yeah.
won't have heard it before.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, it is interesting. I do like the fact that there's a band called Happy End.
Yeah, I mean, without wanting to.
What does that mean, Ian
well,
Deary?
Yeah. Without wanting to get a tricky territory, there's a couple of comical band names like Hachimitsu Pie. And the Dylan 2. If you like
well,
Dylan, you'll like Dylan 2.
The Dylan 2 doing yeah. I Shall Be Released.
Yeah. But I this is, you know, the dictionary definition of not for me, but I thought the song was actually quite interesting. I mean, Gypsy Blood.
Yeah,
with
that was Sugishi a good one. Yeah.
Haiwo Mitsumeti. I mean, that would get Primal Scream all excited over the Buffalo Springfield flavor. And I actually quite liked Ware Ware Wa by Tetsuo Saito, which to me sounded like the opening bits of Space Oddity. But then it's quite nice, as somebody's, you know, we all spend all of our time listening to pop records. It's quite nice, I think, to be completely unmoored from your usual critical kind of steering, you know, steering points.
I think it's interesting in terms
you're off your map, and it's quite nice to hear it.
In some ways, it sounds like a lot of other stuff that I've heard, and this is stuff I've heard a lot of. You know, it is interesting to think, you know, this how people in this part of the world reacted to this music,
I think,
and you know, politically and whatever, but the music itself was not particularly hugely
interesting. And there also I apologise to you if this causes offence, Jude, but there is such particular obsessive one-upmanship in the whole psychedelic folk movement. Last time I did a
You're
big
right, yeah.
once last time I did a big CD clear out, I found, I did count them, this is true, 27 CDs on which the promo sticker said, the lost masterpiece of the psychedelic folk era. Come on, there were not 27 lost masterpieces. They can't all be masterpieces. They were just lost, let's be honest.
But yeah, there was, but you can see, I think if you, if you know, if you think about those artists like Buffalo Daughter and a couple of other artists, Japanese pop bands that came out in the kind of late 90s, early beginning of this century, you can see there's a direct line between these guys, this kind of almost easy listening stuff, and that stuff that those artists were playing around with during the kind of the end of the last century.
I find it historically interesting more than I find listening to music interesting, but it is very good accompanying a lamb stew on a rainy day in Wales.
Will it work with beef?
Sorry?
Will it work with beef?
Dunno.
Wagyu beef. Give it a go. All right, moving on. We haven't done anything from Netflix at all this week, which must be some sort of criminal offence. So let's have a look at Mindhunter, the new crime series based on the memoirs of a member of the FBI's Serial Crimes Unit, and also produced by David Fincher and Charlize Theron. The quick sell is that it's Hannibal Lecter in the 70s with an incarcerated serial killer becoming the source of knowledge for an FBI investigator. But by unfurling at TV pace, it can show you an awful lot more. Let's have a taste.
My name's Bill Tench. This is my partner, Holden Ford. We're from the Federal Bureau of Investigation's Behavioral Science Unit. We're doing research, interviewing men like you.
If you do go to Rockerville, you definitely need to meet Ed Kemper. They call him the co-ed killer.
Do you think the Kemper would talk to us? Try stopping him.
Shepard finds out you've been interviewing the co-ed killer, he'll flip his shit.
It's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. So you're just gonna say and do whatever you want. We decided no one was beneath our contempt.
And that snail didn't change your mind?
What happens to these men is normal, but the way that they process it is not.
I just decided to kill them.
It is not our job to commiserate with these people.
Hello, ladies.
It is our job to electrocute them.
I truly believe there is a vein here that needs to be mined.
If you don't like it, go back to your bedwetting college kids and we'll forget all about it.
Certainly our goal is to be preemptive.
We're the FBI, Holden. That is not our goal. Yet.
David Fincher and Charlize Theron's Mindhunter from Netflix. Jude Rogers, set it up. What's happening here?
So this is about a man called Holden Ford, whose name keeps making me laugh. He was based on a guy called John Douglas, who was the first criminal psychologist, really, the guy who went and met serial killers and defined the idea of the serial killer in the 1970s. We're in the 1970s. There was 70s music. It's shot kind of very much like those independent films of the early 70s, in a style in the dark.
A lot of harsh light. Yeah,
lots of harsh light. You know, looking back to that film noir-y edge that was around in 70s American indie filmmaking. We start with a pre-credit scene where somebody does something shocking, you know, as is what always happens on Netflix, with Netflix films like this, or not just Netflix, any modern deep and meaningful new long-running series. And we go from there, really. We follow John Douglas as... I've seen the first two episodes. And we follow him. He meets a woman and has a girlfriend as well who is studying psychology at university. And she has a little role in it, making him realise he doesn't know as much as he thinks he should. And we go from there, really.
I mean, the core of the show, really, is that you're seeing a turning point in criminal investigation, aren't you, where it goes from the old-fashioned what's the motive and, you know, who's the criminal here too, trying to look into the mind and the mindset of previous inexplicable crimes.
Yeah.
I mean, the big totemic event preceding this series of the Manson murders, which doesn't fit any of the standard MO of the classic murder, they seem to have done it for kicks.
Yeah, and the series is set, it begins immediately in the wake of the Son of Sam murders, with all the FBI people just being baffled as to why someone would kill people because his dog told him to, and they can't understand that. So it's not just about the whys, it's trying to help criminology. But if you can understand why people can do it, why people would do it, you can work out who are the people who might do it, trying to find the character traits. Mm. I mean, sorry, When Andrew suggested this, I hadn't read anything about it, and I saw Mindhunter. I thought, oh God, it's one of those terrible Harrison superhero things about a detective with psychic powers
flying
or something.
Dog. Yeah.
And so I came to it completely blind, and I think it's one of the best things I've ever seen on television. I've watched 7 episodes now. I can't. I'm having to ration myself. because it is incredible. It is so gripping. There was a great interview with David Fincher, which I read after I started watching it, where he was talking about how he got fed up of films because even the films he makes, there's not enough time to develop character. And doing a TV series like this allows him to do it. So he said, I'm perfectly happy to have two people talking in a car for 5 minutes, as long as it develops character and displays power dynamics. I'm perfectly happy for that car to be going at between 25 miles an hour and 35 miles an hour. And quite a lot of the film, quite a lot of the series happens with the two agents, Bill Tench and Holden, driving along in a car, you know, and they're just talking.
Well, there's an interesting thing about it, because there's actually two double acts in that, certainly to the extent that I'm not as far into the show as you are, but there's basically two double acts. There's Bill and Holden, Bill being the older FBI guy who's slightly a wild card because he was earlier on the whole criminal psychology thing, and Holden has kind of found his Obi-Wan to an extent. And there's the other double act, which is Holden and Ed Kemper, the imprisoned serial killer, who plays a big part in earlier episodes and less as it goes on. And you've got in that, there's this, you know, in each case, Holden is almost kind of courting the approval of this older, wiser guy. One of them older in a very legitimate way, the other wiser in much more horrifying ways. And sort of to see this Holden character placed, you know, in this kind of supplicant position, both with those two guys and also with his girlfriend, who's a counterculture lady and, you know, free love and free thinking kind of thing. He is this kind of man sort of in the gap between two worlds.
Well, this is
trying to bridge them.
This is one of the great things about it. The dynamics between the characters shift depending on who's talking to each other. You know, so often in TV shows, it's a character and they behave in X way regardless of who they're talking to. In this, and more characters come in as the series goes on, each character behaves differently, and you see their motivations and their beliefs change. So Bill Tench becomes, I think, a very complex character. Not complex in the hashtag problematic way, just complex. You learn more about him. And, you know, yes, he's the sort of Obi-Wan to Holden's Luke. But also, young Luke becomes more immersed than Tench does. And so their dynamic changes with that as well.
I think, you know, if there is a TV series to compare it to and contrast it with, like Hannibal Lecter, it's Hannibal Lecter meets Mad Men, because that kind of whole, you know, the fact that all the bars they go into have all got that horrible kind of like panelled wood kind of 70s thing, and all the cars, and, you know, even the kind of bits in Quantico where they're all the guys in the gym outfits are all wearing kind of 70s FBI issue gym stuff. It's like, it's just so brilliantly done.
I also want to hail it for the single best ever gig scene, not because it's a band or anything, but you know when you watch films and two people go and see a band and they have a perfectly normal volume conversation and you think, that's not a gig.
That's a quiet band,
He meets his girlfriend at a gig and actually it's filmed and clearly that actually is a band playing on the soundstage. I mean, he and his girlfriend are having shout to each other to get heard, and I thought, alleluia, someone actually has realised what it's like.
Dude, I'm getting the impression you didn't enjoy it that much.
I thought it was all right. I'm thinking, did I watch a different programme, really? No offence, Michael. You know, I respect your opinions.
It's all right, Jude, I'm right, you're wrong.
I just thought, you know, I've seen the first two episodes, I must qualify that, and I'm somebody who does not watch anything anymore that is got a even mild peril in it. After I'm having my dinner at night in front of the telly with my husband, you know, I've just finished the box set of 30 Rock. We've just started on Master of None. You know, I want comedy.
30 Rock takes place quite high up, though. There's mild peril. It's very high up building. Someone could fall off.
They could. And, you know, Alec Baldwin's a dangerous character. I just found it's, you know, maybe I've been thinking about this. You know, I found some of it implausible, but I guess, you know, it's quite implausible us thinking of a world in which criminal psychology is not a thing.
In which, people hadn't invented the concept of the serial killer when the film.
Yeah,
that
absolutely
comes later.
But yeah. I think there's something about the guy who plays Holden Fort. I can't remember his name now.
Jonathan Groff.
Jonathan Groff, who is the voice of one of the characters in Frozen. That's a connection for the parents in the audio. That's his biggest role I know of, anyway. I didn't think he was particularly charismatic. I know he's not supposed to be this thrusting, charismatic character. You know, he's slightly dorky, slightly ordinary and mundane. But I just felt every time he came on the screen, kind of the life was sucked out of it a bit.
That's one of the things I quite liked about it, the fact that I didn't believe that I could find a show so enjoyable and gripping when so little happens.
Yeah, but I'd say I didn't find it enjoyable and gripping. I was one of those weird kids who loved reading about murderers and serial killers. I don't know if people used to go to service stations and pick up books on the world's worst murderers for 99p. I was one of those kids that just loved all this stuff. So I know about all the serial killers already. I've read about all this sort of stuff. I was one of these weird children. I know about Ed Kemper. I've read stuff. I'm not interested in this subject. But I just felt like it didn't contribute anything new. And in terms of the subject that's kind of gripped me in a particularly persuasive way, I also found the 70s music references dropping just very lumpen and leaden. You know, when Psycho Killer comes in, when they're in bed and I'm Not in Love by Tennessee is playing, I just thought, oh God, you know, this is just very obvious and very heavy-handed.
It's a bit on the nose.
It's a bit on the nose, well, yeah. But I'm intrigued, Michael, saying about this character development, because it felt like it was quite slow at the beginning, and maybe, like a lot of great series on American streaming services, I just need to spend a bit more time with it.
Well, also, for all that it is completely preoccupied with serial killers, it's not really a programme about serial killers. It's a programme about being in an institution that does not value the development of knowledge and fighting against that to try and expand knowledge. That's really what it's about.
It's actually a workplace comedy.
Yes, but it's done through the medium of serial killing.
But also, I was quite amused early on to see that I think it has an extremely dry sense of humour in that an extremely tense conversation will, as happens in real life, suddenly be derailed by the stupidest comment going. Like, you know, you'll see an FBI officer complain about the use of curse words in a murder role play, and so it's not really the point. But, you know, under these circumstances, people tend not to be completely, on top of their P's and Q's.
I think the most interesting thing about it was in the first episode. They're talking about how this, about people who hate and we can't understand why they hate and why they do these horrible things. There were lots of things discussed in our first episode that made me think about the way people behave on social media today. There's obviously meant to be linked with the way we treat other people in our society. There's supposed to be these resonances coming through.
But I think it's about the change from that kind of logic-driven Eisenhower, basically pre-rock and roll, imagining that human beings are rational and logical and straightforward, and the post-70s and indeed post-rock and roll, post-counterculture idea that people aren't logical. The mind is a kind of a warring republic of different impulses.
Although it's not even logical, is it? It's more the notion that you can break down human behaviour into a simple division. So people at the FBI genuinely believing that people are murderers because they're evil. You know, so you have the behavioural psychologists go, God, no, that's not what it is at all. Mm. That's not what it is. You've got to look at their lives, which to the FBI hierarchy, this notion that you can explain murder is just an affront. No, the FBI sees these things as a law enforcement issue, and the psychologists see it as a psychology issue. So it's exploring that divide.
The bleeding liberal heart of Michael Hann there. So. Well, listeners, the clock on the wall is making fools of us all. It is time for the show to come to an end and closing time chatter, where our guests let us know what they'll be talking about this weekend as they are cajoled out of a Witherspoon's pub near you. Jude Rogers, what's your closing time chatter?
I took my son to the cinema for the first time last weekend. It's very exciting.
See the death of Stalin?
No, not see the death of Stalin. I probably would have enjoyed taking him to that more than the Jungle Bunch, which Common Sense Media, a site that's supposed to tell you what's good to take your children to see, said, yes, fine, there's no peril. They obviously had the wrong description of the film on this. This was a film with universal rating which featured a bad koala, basically wearing what looks a bit like a suicide vest with lots of little grenades in it.
Jihadi koala. You went to see Jihadi Koala by mistake, Jude. This is not the Jungle Bunch.
That sounds great.
Throwing these little grenades and setting this jungle on fire. In the first 10 minutes, a character dies in this raging forest fire. So we had this going on. We had gorillas beating up other animals, all this kind of stuff. And I'm not Mary Whitehouse. I'm not. I know, I might look a little bit like her. I was just really surprised that this was seen as a suitable film for kids. And talking to some other parents, a lot of them were saying it seems to be in the way that a lot of fun films for kids have stuff for adults in them, you know, jokes that parents will understand, cultural references. Those kind of levels of fear and terror are being brought up too. You know, I saw Watership Down when I was a kid, don't get me wrong. Bambi's mum, kind of, you know, we know what happened to her. But it was, you know, this was somebody throwing basically bombs and blowing up a forest in a way that was very frightening. Well, I was more frightened than my three-year-old, I've got to say. So maybe I was just quite surprised by that. I don't know, you know, Michael, you've got older children. Matt, I don't know if you've experienced this with your kids.
I sometimes wonder about film classification, because, you know, I've got a friend whose two daughters have seen what I think are wildly unsuitable films since they were very young. And he keeps pointing out the certification. So when Die Hard came out, that was an 18 or an X, whatever it was at the time. Die Hard now would probably be a PG. The Bourne films are 12s. The Bourne films like 15 times more violent than any films that were 18s when I was a kid.
Oh, we all got to the age now where it's like, oh, the films are so violent and the records, the records are so like full of sex and so on. Reaching that age.
We are, maybe we are, but you know, koala in a jihadi koala, you know, that's too much.
So you go and see the Jungle Bunch, you're expecting one thing, but I would go and see jihadi koala.
I saw jihadi koala at the Bullen Gate, actually, on a Ouija all dayer.
There you go. Which brings us to you, Michael Hamm, for your closing time chatter.
Sticky Fingers by Joe Hagan, the biography of Jan Wenner and Rolling Stone, which I have been reading because I was writing an essay about rock and roll books. And this is a great book. I think it's one of the great books about rock and roll, precisely because it's not about a rock and roll musician. It's about the man who basically invented the concept of the rock star in the pages of Rolling Stone. And it has become the subject of enormous controversy. Jan Wenner has disowned the book, despite giving full cooperation throughout. It's not an authorised biography, because Joe Hagan didn't want Wenner seeing it before publication. But Wenner is furious that it dwells on prurient matters such as his sexuality and his lifestyle, despite the fact that they clearly, absolutely inform all
everything
his behaviour throughout the entire time he ran Rolling Stone. And I mean, I would actually give full credit to Wenner for cooperating with it, because he really, I appreciate that he must feel betrayed, but he doesn't come out as a hero of this book, but he comes out as a human being as a result. It is a fantastic book. You get a lot of detail, perhaps, about the running of American magazines in the 1970s, but that you don't need to know. But you
unless
also,
you're a tedious old magazine boy like me.
I was going to say, all right, me.
But you get some details that will make both you and I, who have edited glossy magazines, quite jealous, like the editor of Us Weekly being paid $3.8 million per year.
Oh, God. Has it got lots of stuff about typefaces and
it has stuff about typefaces and fonts, yes.
Is it out yet?
And borders.
And borders, emeralds,
yes.
Point sizes. Is it out yet?
I can't remember if it's out right now, but if not, it's out within the next week or so.
Okay, Sticky Fingers. Matt Hall, what have you got?
So I was listening to Woman's Hour on Monday. And
thanks, that
they
was great.
They interviewed a woman called Katie Turr, who's the NBC correspondent who followed Trump from the very beginning of his campaign all the way through to now that he's the president. And this woman is a very experienced, very savvy, live broadcast journalist, which makes this clip where she, which I had to go and get, and I thought they'd have actually, I didn't think they'd include it on the listen again, but thankfully they either couldn't be bothered to clip it out or whatever. But basically, a clip where she's explaining to the host, Jane Garvey, how it wasn't just male Trump supporters who were being slagging off journalists and being kind of quite misogynistic on the campaign trail.
There was this feeling among women, which was, I guess, surprising to me, was how they were willing to denigrate other women and how they were willing to denigrate Hillary Clinton.
In particular.
In particular, there were men wearing shirts that said Hillary sucks, but not like Monica. Women wore those shirts as well. Women standing next to their husbands wearing shirts that said Hillary Clinton is a C-U-N-T with their kids there. A woman standing proudly next to her husband who said, I wished Hillary married OJ, which
right.
says...
I should just say at this point, I think it is half term actually throughout much of the country. So if anybody was offended by that term, I do apologise, but it happened, Katie. You're
no,
absolutely
I'm
right.
sorry. I'm yeah, spelling no, that's it fine. Out, hoping not to actually just say it. But that did, it did happen. And I think it's important not to sugarcoat it. It happened in America.
Now, obviously that can't be broken, but just two things. One, just imagining the sheer panic in the control room as they realise as they realise what she's just done. But two, She's an experienced broadcast journalist. You couldn't do that on NBC. You'd be drummed out of. You wouldn't get another job in American journalism.
She probably thinks it's a lovely podcast like ours. Yeah, Radio 4, is that like, I don't know, is it like a college show?
But I thought Jane Garvey handled it very well, but it was still made me laugh lots.
Fantastic. Well, my closing time chatter is a very short one. The design firm 67 Inc. have turned bands into beer mats. David Bowie's Double Diamond Dogs, Underworld Lager, 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 Kink's Preservation Ale, Pilsner. And they've done a Manchester set as well with the 808 Stout, New Order Temptation Ale, and of course Smith's Bitter. These are beautifully reproduced. They look like proper beer mats, beautifully redesigned in the 70s style. Available as a lovely poster from 67 Inc. Personally, I think they've missed out on Liverpool. What's wrong with the Ale Fountains, Lagertron, and the Beer Tap Explodes? But I encourage you to Google up 67 and have a look at their beautiful band beer bats, because they look really nice on your wall. And there's your show. Thank you to Jude Rogers and Michael Hand for making it all the way here to talk to us. Please do come again. Remember, viewers, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. Matt and I will be back next week with more exciting people. See you then. Bye-bye.